From Tucson, Arizona, that's Native American flutist Ray Carlos Nakai of Navajo Ute heritage with Ancestral Home. It's from his 1989 album, Canyon Trilogy, which, along with his Earth Spirit album, both are the only Native American albums to be certified gold and platinum, respectively, by the Recording Industry Association of America. More than 30 of Nakai's recordings have been preserved by the Library of Congress, the American Folklife Center there. Nakai was inducted into the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame in 2005. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, August the 10th, 2015. In the second half of our program, we'll talk about a major legal fight that is coming up, one hopes, in the courts of New York. We'll get to that in the second half, but first, we are going nuclear. And that is to say that we are talking about the sad and scary state of affairs that exists in the United States with respect to its nuclear programs and nuclear waste. And there is a connection here. Of course, the music suggests it. Much of this is occurring on ancestral lands of Native Americans. And it's a discussion that basically ought to be had because Japan is still commemorating the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the immediate impact was immense in terms of loss of life, almost approximating, it is estimated, about 400,000 people. But the after effects of radiation poisoning and the nuclear impact has still been incalculable. People are saying even the DNA on that day was changed for so many, and it would go into the future for several generations to come. I am delighted to welcome to the program my peer and friend, Paul DiRienzo, who, as you may recall, had spent some time with us talking about the massive nuclear catastrophe at the Hanford site along the Columbia River in South Central Washington State. And that series was titled America's Fukushima, talking about the incredible impact that this particular site has had on ancestral lands, but also on everything in it, under it, around it, above it. It's been extraordinary. And yet, not very much is it's not in the psyche of the American people because it's just not covered. It just isn't given that much coverage, but it is a huge, huge disaster. And as Paul has been telling us, the attempts to clean up the waste, how these plants got built, how they tied into America's nuclear defense programs, and the shoddy ways in which the nuclear waste has been handled as if it could ever be handled competently, really, the impact, immediate and long-term impact of these nuclear plants. And Paul, what a great joy it is to have you with us again.
Sure is, Eutrice. Thanks a lot for this opportunity. Appreciate that.
Thank you. So let's start with this, the question about this nuclear waste. I was reading that on February the 5th in 2014, the U.S. Department of Energy said a salt-hauling truck caught fire at its waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico, an underground collection, processing, and storage plant for nuclear and radioactive waste from a Defense Department weapons facility located in Los Alamos, Texas. Workers were evacuated. Six were treated for smoke inhalation, and part of the plant was shut down, according to the Department of Energy.
The entire plant has been shut down.
Yeah, we'll get to that. 9 days later, workers on the night shift on February the 14th heard an explosion close to the operating location where waste was being emplaced, according to the Department of Energy. The next day, air monitors detected, according to the department, very low levels of airborne radioactive contamination. But you, who have done a six-part series on nuclear, the nuclear program and its catastrophic consequences, you say there's something else here to this report, and it is indicative of where America's nuclear weapons industry is and where the issue is about regulation and handling nuclear waste. What is the real story behind that second explosion that on the night of February the 14th?
Everybody seems to be excited by the kitty litter. nuclear waste was packed in barrels with kitty litter, and to the best of my knowledge, it was supposed to be inorganic kitty litter, but according to the report, they misread it as inorganic kitty litter. And when they mixed the organic kitty litter with the waste, it produced what they called a patented plastic explosive. Then the barrel, according to Secretary of Energy Moniz, had a thermal event. Most other people call it exploded because it went up to 1,600 degrees, which is enough to melt iron or something. And it spread plutonium particles not only throughout the very, very large site. It's an underground, 2,000 feet underground mine, salt mine, built over about a 13-year period to contain this waste for well over 100,000 years. And the idea was after the waste is filled, the salt would actually crush and become one with the waste, and that this would be held underground for that 100,000 years. But actually within moments of the thermal event or explosion, depending on how you like to call it, alarms went out throughout the area on the surface showing plutonium had escaped. And that the eventually, although it took over a year to find out, plutonium particles were found miles and miles away. And the threat from plutonium is that if you ingest it, internalize it, and it gets into your lungs, it can cause lung cancer. The smallest little particle can cause lung cancer.
I'm kind of stuck here for a minute. When you said kitty litter,
yeah,
most people would kind of say, are you telling me that nuclear waste, the government is managing the disposal of nuclear waste with kitty litter?
Well, it's clay. The organic, inorganic kitty litter is clay, basically. And it, something has to absorb liquid inside these tanks. What low-level waste is, the type of waste, transuranic waste, which they're burying there is basically stuff, you know, the junk clothing, contaminated tools, you know, a coffee cup, that kind of stuff. And it's just that in 70 years of, you know, 75 years of production of nuclear weapons, they've produced enough of that kind of detritus to fill maybe as many as two Empire State Buildings. And they're sitting in, you know, out all over the place. And they just wanted a place to consolidate it all together. Most of that waste is in itself, you know, not so much directly dangerous, but when you put it all together in one place, it does risk more danger. And so, you know, plutonium is a strange substance. If you put enough of it together, it's, you know, it can explode just by being close, but too much of it in one place can make a nuclear explosion. And so it's called it goes critical or super critical. And so there's many accidents that happened where there was a bucket by a door in one case where there was a couple of gallons of plutonium waste with plutonium in it. And somebody came in and dumped a, you know, coffee cup amount of more nuclear waste into the bucket to get rid of, you know, for a moment, you know, before it was removed. And that actually caused a nuclear explosion that killed a few people. So the stuff is, you know, it's so amazing when I talk about nuclear. I think people don't really understand, and it's hard to get your mind around the phenomenal power inside of that equals MC squared. What that means is that, an amount of, I think, for example, you were talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I believe that when they, you know, it was a very inefficient bomb that they dropped in Hiroshima. And actually, when they researched later, only 1 gram of the uranium, or I think it's the Nagasaki bomb, 1 gram of the plutonium was actually fissioned. Most of the rest was just blown apart and never just into dust, into the air, and never actually did ignite. The 1 gram, that's, you know, basically a table, a teaspoonful in your hand of powder, destroyed an entire city. And so that gives you some idea of what we're dealing with, the phenomenal amount of power. And a small error can have unbelievably, powerful consequences. And I think that's, you know, when you're dealing with nuclear, what people don't realize is just, you know, how much power humanity has unleashed by controlling the atom. And in ways, it makes you wonder who's controlling who. Is the atom controlling us, or are we controlling the atom? Even scientists, many scientists, and I'm to give a broad, you have to look at it broadly for a minute. Scientists, I believe it was even the father of the nuclear navy, a man I respect. A lot of these people who develop this stuff, I mean, you can't hold back technology. Technology and scientific studies, I mean, humanity's been trying to figure out what matter was made out of for thousands of years in every civilization. And it came, finally, they did figure it out. And it was able to destroy them, what they discovered, after all those thousands of years of study and questioning of it. That the power in that waste is, it's really not the nuclear that's the problem. The problem is the people who are now, their power has been increased by it. And so, Admiral Rickover, you know, did what he was a man of his time, and he did what he thought was right. But he, in his later life, said, why would you bring, life exists on Earth because a shield exists in our upper atmosphere that keeps the radiation from the sun and outer space from hitting us every day, the cosmic rays and other things that could come and would sterilize the Earth. And why would you want to actually bring that stuff on the other side of the shield with us? That's what Rickover said. And so, and when you look at the sun and those amazing pictures of those prominences on the sun, I mean, that's the power of the sun we've brought to the Earth. And whether that's a wise idea or not, I'll let other people debate. But that's what's happened. And so even though you have like a pair of coveralls and a hammer and a contaminated coffee cup and you put it in a barrel and a little bit of the coffee that was on the bottom of the cup spills out and is liquid there, and you have to put some absorbent in there to absorb it, to pack the drum tight before you send it down to the storage mine 2,000 feet down. And use clay. That's what's used. I mean, kitty litter is clay. And, you know, if you're looking at the clock, you got a couple of barrels to do. Hey, Joey, could you run down to the Kmart and pick up a couple of bags of clay, you know, let's see, the instructions here say inorganic kitty litter. All right, get some organic sweet brand kitty litter. All right, I'll be down back in an hour. And the guy comes back to his pickup truck and takes out a couple of sacks of the stuff and brings it over, and they pack it in there and they write down on the computer where exactly everything that's in there and what they packed it with. Only they put the wrong information. You know, they see garbage in, garbage out. So they put the wrong information on the computer. The computer says everything's fine. If they put the right information, the computer would have like, bam, 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 bam. No. Explosive. No, but they didn't put the right information in the computer, so the computer couldn't help them. And then they buried the waste down there. And eventually, the organic compounds in the organic kitty litter combined with the plutonium and the other, the coffee grinds or whatever was in there, you know, and actually formed something that could ignite. And it did ignite. And when it ignited, it went up to 1,600 degrees, which is like the inside of a blast furnace. And it vaporized everything inside of it under pressure and forced it out, you know, into a huge area. And it sucked it into the ventilation system. And it sucked it into the filters that were supposed to prevent the particles from getting out onto the surface. And it just was so forceful, it just shoot right through the protective filters and past the airlocks and everything and right out into the atmosphere. And the alarms started going off, bang, 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 bang. You know, lights started shining. People saw a strange, eerie, bleak, green light. The workers said they were scared. They ran, you know, because they knew how dangerous that could be. And so it took 1 year later, and the final report comes out about what happened. And so we're talking about one barrel of waste, one barrel of waste, one barrel of waste. The day the report comes out, we discover, oh, it was 500 barrels of waste that were improperly packed at Los Alamos National Laboratories in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the place where the atom bomb was built. You know, the spot that was picked by Robert Oppenheimer, where the main brain trust of the American nuclear weapons complex is located to this very day. The smartest men in the world, smartest men in America and women in America, physicists, scientists, engineers, and they made a mistake, a foolish, foolish mistake, one that they're, I'm sure, wringing their heads over. And they sent 500 barrels of waste. Now, that was when I wrote this article for whowhatwhy.org. And you can go to my site, Paul DiRienzo, whowhatwhy.org, and see the articles I've read, written about this stuff. And I'm working on a new one. And the new article was after I discovered it was 500 barrels of waste. I then discovered from sources, people calling me up from New Mexico and Texas and saying, people from Texas saying, who, despite all the stories you hear about Texas, Texas is a lot of really progressive people down there, you know, and you'd be surprised. You know, I talked to a lot of progressive people in Texas, and they're like, don't want this stuff in their community.
Lon Burnham is a former state senator in Texas. He is an environmental activist and something of an expert on Texas politics, I imagine. Thank you, Lon Burnham, for being with us today.
I'm delighted to be with you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, can I thank you for pulling over to do this interview.
Well, I am literally returning to Texas from having been in Los Alamos yesterday for the 70th anniversary commemoration of the bombing of Nagasaki with several hundred fellow activists in a very now beautiful site, but it was the birthplace of the atom bomb. Those folks were gathered to commemorate that, but I spend most of my time where I was raised and live in Fort Worth, Texas, and I have been an anti-nuke activist for almost as long as I can remember now. I served 18 years in the Texas legislature, and during that period in the Texas House of Representatives, I was almost single-handedly responsible for killing some bad waste legislation. But there is a billionaire who may be known to some of the people on the East Coast as Harold Simmons, who funded the campaigns against Senator Kerry, et cetera. Texas is, like a whole lot of other states, kind of fundamentally corrupt in its state government. But ours, you know, we do everything bigger. And Harold Simmons is essentially locked in control of the Texas legislature. And so in 2003, we passed legislation as a part of our commitment to the Waste Compact Commission. We've authorized a site and privatized what should have been a public responsibility to allow Harold Simmons, the billionaire, to make millions of more dollars in a site that is located very close to the WIPP site. If people can visualize the map the state of Texas, that big north-south line between New Mexico and Texas, down at the south end on the state line, we have waste control specialists, commercial nuclear waste, most of it, like 97% of it, generated by nuclear power plants on the Texas side, and then just a few miles to the west on the road from Andrews, Texas to Carlsbad, New Mexico, you have the WIP site, which is where we refer to it as Kitty Litter Gate. Here, activists in Texas and New Mexico, and you heard that very well described just now, the problem that was created by the inappropriate packing and managing of the waste from Los Alamos. And it was pointed out earlier, you know, supposedly some of the greatest minds and physicists in the world have been at the Los Alamos or LANL site for, 70-odd years now, more than 70 years. But the fact of the matter is the facility itself is horribly mismanaged, and we have a tremendous problem with any number of mistakes being made at the LANL facility with the most dangerous product in the world, this plutonium. And so it is pretty discouraging, actually, at how bad the management has been over the years and the problems that we have. I have returned to Texas from a 3-week volunteer stint with Nuclear Watch New Mexico, and the Nuclear Watch New Mexico folks are based in Santa Fe, but they do most of their work in trying to monitor the activity of the LANL facility, which is a huge problem. But I want to take us back to a particular concern of mine, which is the uncontrolled, ever-expanding role of the waste control specialist site in Andrews County on the state line. And it's this. The national concept behind this legislation was for each state to assume its responsibility for the commercial nuclear waste that they have made. But Vermont and Maine were scheduled to be in our compact. But Maine has withdrawn. Vermont is a part of this. But ever since the legislation passed back in 2003, they've had mission creep and expanding their responsibilities and what they're willing to accept. Such that as a practical matter, the waste site in Andrews, Texas has become the waste site for most states in the country. And now there's a major legislative initiative in Washington, and it will occur in the Texas legislature, to enable us to take most of the high-level waste as well as the low-level waste. And that's the reason I have returned to Amarillo. I started my 4-week sojourn here in Amarillo working with people on the Peace Farm, and I'm going to be visiting with people at the Peace Farm again as soon as we finish this interview, talking about what can be done by the people in Amarillo and Lubbock who have reason to be concerned that all this high-level waste is going to be trucked through their communities to this poorly managed waste dump site in Andrews County.
Mm-hmm. Ron Burnham, Paul DeRienzo here. I wanted to ask you in particular about the controversy over the aquifer, the Oglala Aquifer, which covers 175,000 square miles, provides water for 27% of United States agriculture in almost half a dozen states. And the initial reports that were used to license WCS, Waste Control Specialists, was claimed that there was no route to the aquifer underneath their waste dump. And yet that it turned out later that the university that made that study was chancellored by an appointee of the same politicians who supported it, and that later studies showed that, in fact, there was a route to that extremely important water source.
It's really important for people to know that just how corrupt things are here. They changed the maps. The initial maps that you would look at in the early 90s through the 90s has the Ogallala Aquifer, which is one of the largest in the Northern Hemisphere and extends over like eight of our breadbasket states from the Dakotas south to Texas, extended below this site. Then they drew new maps where it's not quite that far south, but you had three employees of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, the licensing agency, quit as whistleblowers, saying this was a bad site for it to be located in. And the subsequent just factual information is they claim there's no aquifer there, but in reality, they dug the hole so deep that they can't keep water out of there. So in what is theoretically a very dry part of the country, in reality, if you dig deep enough, you're going to hit an aquifer. They've hit an aquifer, and for months at a time, they have had to have water pumps pumping water out of this aquifer. It's just another example of how corrupt the decision-making process is, and how flawed the engineering and science is in dealing with some of the riskiest material in the world.
I want to ask a question here because it occurs to me, I'm not nearly as well versed as you and Paul are on this subject, but it does seem to me that a common thread here is that many of these nuclear plants are located along or in or on ancestral lands, Native American ancestral lands. Was that accidental? That's the first question. And secondly, what when you differentiated between commercial waste, nuclear waste, and I imagine governmental defense department associated waste, what's the proportion
Paul,
here and who's
that?
Regulating
it? Okay, Paul, let me take a run with it first.
Sure.
I mean, my own political analysis is people were so horrified by what they saw in 1945 that they began to look for a domestic, commercially viable reason to have developed this technology, and hence the move towards nuclear power. While most nuclear power plants are actually in the Midwest and on the East Coast, the uranium mining occurs on Navajo country, and one of the tragic anniversaries that we have just observed in New Mexico, in addition to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is July 16, 1945, was the first experiment on a civilian population in a long time, that Trinity test site, above-ground test, the downwinders of Tularosa suffer cancer at about seven times the rate of the rest of the country. But the other population group that you're asking about are the Navajo people in northwestern New Mexico, where the uranium mining has occurred, and ironically and tragically, on July 16, 1979, the retaining wall holding the radioactive mill tailings broke, and all of this washed down into the Pueco River, a river that the Navajo people have been consigned to because of our reservation policies, but use as a water supply to both drink and irrigate their crops. So these people on subsistence use of arid region water, their whole river basin is polluted with radioactive materials. There is a film that's about 20 years old now where you can see the result of the birth defects, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, you know, the DNA situation is something that we should all be most concerned about, the impact on DNA on both the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the victims of the mining mill tailing process is that crosses the placenta, and it poisons and changes the DNA of future generations. And most people are just very complacently unaware of the tragedy that we have imposed on indigenous people in New Mexico because of the uranium mining cycle and use. And it's almost a cruel outcome that they are the victims at both the beginning of the process and the end, because this region of the country, I feel like, has been designated as a wasteland that, well, it's a sacrifice zone. We've all can remember the Secretary of State that referred to children in Iraq in the 90s as collateral damage. Well, they were preschoolers, and you're calling them collateral damage.
That was, and that was the first female. You talk about Madeleine Albright.
Well, I'm glad you acknowledged that. I wasn't going to point it out. Yes, she made this outrageous comment, and we have people in this country that are considered collateral damage, and most of them are third world people in this country who are victims of extractive processes like uranium. I am live in the Barnett Shale. There's increasing evidence that all the shale activity is also bringing up radioactive material. And it's really interesting to see privileged upper middle class white people living in the Barnett Shale getting very irritated about being treated like a third world people.
Paul, do you want to tackle the question about the relationship between commercially produced nuclear waste and Defense Department related nuclear waste and the management of both?
I firmly believe that most of these distinctions between types of nuclear waste are absolutely artificial and were created for the purpose of, obfuscation and really to confuse the issue more than anything. I mean, nuclear waste is nuclear waste. It's as the uranium and plutonium break down into daughter particles that contain energy and release particles, alpha, beta, and gamma particles, X-rays. And that's what it is. That's what waste is. Things that emit that stuff that's created artificially in nuclear reactors and nuclear experimentation and has to be disposed of, because some of it is dangerous for maybe a few months. Some of it's dangerous for a few days. You know, some of it's dangerous for 100,000 years. And these distinctions are unbelievably, in my opinion, artificial. So you have transuranic waste. That's all waste that contains plutonium. Then you have low-level waste, which is A, B, and C, which is basically all the junk and detritus of the business, which fills up huge areas that has to be disposed of. Every time people go to work, they have to drop off their clothes and their own coveralls and shoes, and they throw them into a waste dump, and they have to do something with them when they run out of places to keep the stuff. And then you have nuclear power plants, which are purposely made to irradiate uranium in order to produce electricity, to get those uranium atoms to fission in a controlled way inside of a nuclear power plant. And then after, a year or 2 years of operations, there's all kinds of wasteful products that are created by the fissioning, the splitting of the uranium atoms into other things, barium, lead, sodium, all those things, the xenon, krypton, and they're all radioactive for different amounts of time. And they have to be disposed of somewhere. And it's basically a nuclear waste problem right now. Commercial nuclear waste tends to be smaller in quantity but higher in radioactivity, because it's purposely made to be radioactive inside a nuclear reactor, while defense waste, for the most part, tends to be huge amounts of more lightly radioactive substances that are just, the polluted equipment and machines that they use, the necessary that they have to wear and use, as I was just describing. So with commercial nuclear plants, you have where are you going to put this highly radioactive waste? It has to be kept away from people. It's not a huge amount of it, but it's so dangerous that it transcends the amount, because if it's anybody 1,000 years from now or 10,000 years from now comes across this stuff, they could be as damaged as somebody tomorrow. And what they do with commercial waste is it's not allowed to be dumped. You have to keep it on site. Every nuclear plant has to keep its nuclear waste on site until a nationally approved waste dump is developed, and they have one. It's called Yucca Mountain in Nevada. But Harry Reid became a very powerful political figure, the United States Senator from Nevada, and he said immediately, "I'm going to use my power to keep this stuff from going into my home state because my citizens and residents of Nevada don't want it." So they have the Yucca Mountain waste dump sitting there empty. It's not going to take any waste. Nobody wants it. So where's it going to go? It just keeps piling up and piling up in pools, water pools, underneath water. Water, actually, as long as you can keep the water over it, is a good shield. It keeps the radiation away. But if the water boils away or leaks or goes through a crack in the bottom, then you're in a lot of trouble. Or now they have dry casks, these special sealing that they're going to be driving all over the country on trucks to bring to this place and that place. But basically, it's all being kept on site of America's 100 nuclear power plants. Now, the same thing was happening in Japan and Fukushima, and they put it in water pools, the spent fuel, on top of the nuclear power plant in racks. And when the earthquake happened, the pools cracked and the water came out and the spent fuel started to overheat and spew radioactive particles into the environment. And that's one of the main problems they have right now at Fukushima. It's going to be leaking and polluting the water, the cooling water that they have to pour over it by letting like a river, basically diverting a river to run over it to keep it cool, is taking all that radioactive material out into the ocean. And it goes on the currents, and they actually pick it up in California and places like that. So it gets everywhere. And that's one of the scariest things about nuclear waste. If you get a little bit on your hand and then go to a doorknob, you leave it on the doorknob, somebody comes behind you, gets it on the doorknob, they bring it somewhere else, somebody comes and gets it, and it can spread all over the place. And right now we have two regimes. One, the defense regime, which was supposed to go to WIP. That's closed because of the disaster we were talking about. And we have the commercial regime, which was supposed to go to Yucca, is not going to go to Yucca Mountain, and is just sitting on board waiting for an earthquake or a hurricane or a tornado or a terrorist attack at all these nuclear power plants across America. And with no place to go. Now, Waste Control Specialist has just recently applied for a license to accept commercial nuclear waste, basically spent fuel rods, and to bury them on site, and which, is an admission that the plan to use Yucca Mountain is dead, even after they spent billions of dollars building it, and that this very dangerous waste is going to be trucked across the United States, and basically, Waste Control Specialist is just a hole in the ground. I mean, it's real, in many ways, to me, it's a real admission of defeat. All these complex underground mines and ideas they had that would forever keep the waste out, that were so brilliantly executed and engineered, have failed miserably. And the only thing left in the end is just sticking it in a hole in the ground somewhere.
Paul, thanks. Lon Berman, thank you so much for opening up this discussion today. And to open our eyes about it. And I would love to continue this in the same way we did, Paul, with a series on understanding the enormity of the problem and the lack of regulation and management of nuclear waste. We'll talk again about Paul. You did a fantastic article in Who, What, Why on discovering plutonium, remnants of plutonium in Queens and in Staten Island, where people are living completely unknown to them that they are, in fact, living on radioactive materials. So thanks so much for being with me today and for sharing what you know with the audience. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Just really glad to participate, and please don't hesitate to call again. It's important that we get the word out all over the country.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. We'll take this break and come right back to a legal fight that's brewing. listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. Tomorrow, between the hours of 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. in New York City, the New York County Lawyers Association will be holding a public meeting, a public hearing on attorney discipline. And it is my understanding that a very important attorney will be making a presentation tomorrow. He's at least scheduled to do so. That attorney is Alton Maddox, who has been prevented illegally and unconstitutionally, in my opinion, from practicing law in the state of New York. He joins us now. Thanks, Alton, for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation, Eutrice.
Well, tell us what's happening tomorrow and what is your part in it?
Well, I tell you, it's been a long struggle just to get a hearing. Most people may not recognize the fact that it has taken demands on both the governor, the chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals, the New York State Attorney General, Pihar Barawa of the U.S. Attorney's Office, and others to get to this point in time. And it's been very exhausting. And then when we found out it wasn't going to be a public hearing, and we just ran into a bunch of other roadblocks, starting with a roadblock in upstate New York that was artificial, and then a demand for the censorship of my testimony, which I had to skirt around. And at the last moment, I have now found out that I am the 15th of 16 witnesses that will be testifying tomorrow at the New York County Lawyers Association, 14 VC Street, in Manhattan. And so we will, in the short period of time that we have, and the other thing I've been demanding, I think that the community has to really chime in on this, is that there has to be a plenary hearing on judicial racism, and rather than a summary hearing on attorney discipline. And I think that's very important for our community to understand, because we are the biggest consumers of the criminal justice system. We are ones that are mostly affected by it. It has not delivered quality merchandise to our community. We have been shortchanged as a result of it. And now we are asking those who claim to be consumer watchdogs to show up tomorrow at New York County Lawyers Association building at 14 Vesey Street to demand that their voices be heard as well.
Now, you have been, as you claim, constructively disbarred for more than 25 years, and this has to do with your representation of the family and of Tawana Brawley, who had made a charge that she was kidnapped and held prisoner over the holiday weekend, Thanksgiving holiday weekend in 1987, was it? And repeatedly sexually assaulted by as many as six men, including a man who was then an assistant district attorney in Dutchess County. Why was this move against you, why did it occur as far as the state contends?
Well, I think it really started much earlier than just Tawana Brawley. But, you know, that's one of the more recent matters. But when you go back and look at my legal career, I was initially investigated by Cyrus Vance Sr., former Secretary of State, in Harlem in the 1970s, and then it graduated to Robert Morgenthau, and then afterwards a criminal prosecution by Robert Morgenthau and a grand jury investigation by Rudolph Giuliani, which then turned into a
judicial ordeal by New York State Attorney General Robert Abrams. So I think it really spans my entire career, and it certainly involves the fact that I have just been one of those persons who have doggedly insisted on black people being treated fairly by the criminal justice system. And lately, you know, I did a tremendous amount of research in this area, and I found out that it wasn't personal for New York. It was actually business, because since the first black attorney was allowed to practice law in New York in 1847, it has always been a hostile workplace for black lawyers. Unfortunately, far too many of them have refused to speak out against it. And that enables New York to continue to this process. And I have been one of those who have always believed that we should leave our workplace better than where we found it.
Well, I'll tell you that I'm very much aware, because I've been covering the cases that you've handled over the many, many years. You have never been convicted of any crime or any ethical lapse at all as a professional. There's no legal mark against you. The specious claims, I would call them specious. I mean, when the state attorney general, then state attorney general Robert Abrams, says, goes to the state legislature, I research this, and unless I'm inadequate there, you could correct me. There doesn't seem to be on record any attorney at all who has been prevented or disbarred or suspended ad infinitum in perpetuity simply because the state attorney general goes to the legislature. It was, you were actually suspended by the legislature. The lawyers committee has not moved against you, but the legislature did. How do you explain that?
Well, it really definitely unusual, maybe even unprecedented, because the attorney disciplinary process is actually based on private clients. Those are the ones who have been given the authority to initiate a disciplinary investigation. And you correctly stated, everybody who initiated a complaint against me were all public officials, starting with the first complaint by the New York State Legislature, a body of legislative officials, and then secondly by Stephen Pagonas, who had actually raped Tawana Brawley, and then afterward by Bob Abrams himself, another public official who took up the banner and, as you correctly indicated, required my indefinite suspension from the practice of law, which has now transcended a quarter of a century, and it doesn't seem like there's no relief in sight.
Now, you had asked the disciplinary committee for a public hearing, and that was denied you. Why now are they allowing you to testify publicly?
Well, I think the problem that New York finds itself in is there is a larger investigation going on in New York, and you already have the Assembly Speaker Silver, the Majority Leader Skelos, already under indictment, and it appears that the Governor of New York may be within reach. And then you have the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals who is sitting somewhere on the sidelines watching. And I think that the reality is that the government in New York is more perilous than people think or realize, and that you're dealing with a triumvirate in which New York has operated with only three men being allowed to make major decisions, which in effect means that everybody in the state has been disenfranchised, and the New York's attorney now is facing, and these other public officials are facing with the complaints that I'm making, and I believe that this is just really an effort to poo-poo the entire process and to whitewash a public hearing and a public record, and which would eliminate the need for public policy and ultimately public legislation.
Will your testimony tomorrow in any way affect a decision to reverse your the strange world that you have inhabited for 25 years, not disbarred, but barred?
Well, you know, my initial concern here is the concern that Bill Cosby and other blacks have where they find themselves in trouble. And that is to deal with your own reputation. I mean, first and foremost, if I go down in history, I want to go down with a reputation that deserves respect. And in that regard, that is my initial concern, because that is totally unwarranted. As you indicated before, I did nothing. I created no problems as far as any client is concerned. I caused nobody in the courthouse problems in terms of a judge holding me in contempt and being able to sustain the charge. And so, therefore, you know, my position is that I should never be a subject of a disciplinary process at all, and that the fact that I have been victimized by this only has caused great irreparable harm to myself, that I would initially demand that this disciplinary process consider. And then afterward, obviously, it would be the question of, after having regained your reputation, to be able to initially and ultimately go into the practice of law again.
So will this committee, this Lawyers Association, have any sway at all in reversing your current status?
Well, I would think that they would, because ultimately the person who is ultimately responsible for statewide discipline of lawyers is the chief judge of the Court of Appeals. And so he has not divested himself of that authority in my case or in anybody else's case. And I think that the chief judge would have to have the responsibility of correcting any injustices that is brought to his attention. And clearly, I have tried to bring that to his attention privately in terms of writing letters to him and other public officials. But this would now be a public record. And my contention is that once you are on record and demonstrating those injustices on record, then some action has to be done. And in the law, they call it sui sponte action. That means you doing it on your own. You don't have to rely on somebody else to ask you to do it. You could just simply look at the record and say, well, you know, this is an injustice. And sui sponte, I'm going to correct it.
But, you know, my reporter's instinct tells me that it could also go the other way, that your very testimony may begin a public inspection of the corrupt system that has singled you out for punitive action, unprecedented, unconstitutional, illegal, and that by your testimony, you will now call the entire system to account. And this may just galvanize the opposition to you. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. You know, it certainly would galvanize the opposition. But then at some point, you know, the right of representation belongs to the people. And the question is, what will the people do after they have been given notice as well that this injustice exists? And I think that it would be unfair or wrongful to believe that the people would just throw up their hands in the face of any injustice, especially one that is not only causing personal pain, but one that is causing pain to an entire group, because we seem to dominate the criminal justice system. And we also tend to dominate those who have been victimized by law enforcement agencies. And so I think you're absolutely right. There will become galvanization on the part of opposition. But I would hope to think that our own people would rise up in defense, and ultimately the people will win.
So that's tomorrow from 11 to 2. At the New York County Lawyers Association building at 14 Vizzy Street. That's between Broadway and Church Street in Lower Manhattan. And I am so sad that I'm not going to be there, because I really did enjoy covering the cases that you litigated, and in many cases set precedent, legal precedents in many cases. So I wish you the best. And we'll follow up on what happens tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today, Alton.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice, and I hope everybody get on the horn and call everybody that they know and demand that they also be present tomorrow to witness this unprecedented hearing.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was useful and informative. I certainly learned a lot. And we will come back to each other tomorrow. We'll be talking about a number of cases and movements that we need to take note of. Our guest will be Gerald Horn. So until then, please know it is a pleasure and a great privilege for me to be in your esteemed company. Keep it right here on PRN, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.